Well, Peter finishes up his letter by reminding them why he wrote the letter in the first place. And you can see it there in verse 12. So jump right in with me. Peter says, "With the help of Silas, whom I regard as a faithful brother, I've written to you briefly, encouraging you and testifying that this is the true grace of God. Stand fast in it." So he says, I'm writing to you to encourage you, remind you of the truth of God, the grace of God, and to tell you just stand fast in it. Stay in it. Don't move from the gospel. Cling to it. Hang in there. And that's a particularly helpful thing that they need to be told, because they're going through what Peter calls a fiery ordeal. They're copping it for being Christians. They're being persecuted for their faith. And so Peter's writing this letter to encourage them, tell them to hang in there. But I've got to say, one of the surprising things I find about this letter is the way Peter does that. You see, if I was looking at people who are going through a hard time, they're copping it for being Christians, I'd be tempted to say to them something like, "Guys, you've got to be courageous, you've got to be bold, you've got to be strong, you've got to stand up, you've got to fight." You know, that's what I'd be tempted to say. But Peter does something really surprising. One of the big messages of this letter is he says, "Guys, here's what you got to do. You just got to be really humble. You got to pursue an entire life of humble submission to authorities, and particularly to the ultimate authority, your God. Humility is the big thing that the Christians need to hear about when they're in the midst of persecution. Humility is the big thing the church needs to take hold of to survive and thrive. Humility is going to be the big thing we need to continue to press into to survive as Christians and to thrive as God's church and bring Him glory." Have a look at the verse kind of right in the middle of chapter 5 there, verse 5. And I want to take you right to that because I think that's the key thing going on here for us, humility. We'll read from the beginning of verse 5. "In the same way, you who are younger, submit to yourselves to your elders." We'll come back to that in a minute. But then look what he says. "All of you, clothe yourselves with humility toward one another, because God opposes the proud and shows favour to the humble." See the language he uses? Clothe yourselves with humility, which literally means put it on. Put humility on. And here's God basically giving us our dress code as Christians. Here's what we've got to put on, you know? And God is the one who's allowed to decide what's in fashion, you know? What he thinks is cool and worth wearing is ultimately what we need to listen to. And God says you need to put on humility. And don't put it on just in the surface level way. Don't just have the appearance of humility on the outside. But from the very center of who you are, let your heart pursue humility and be a humble person. Which means, for me personally, I'm thinking, okay, I need to live not for the cause of Tim. I need to live for the cause of Jesus. Because true humility is to set aside personal interest for the sake of others. Set aside your own interest for the interest of, ultimately, God. That's true humility. And that can have lots of different appearances and lots of different personalities, but the humble person pursues the cause of God and lays aside their own cause. Now, why is that so important? Well, God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. That's a kind of general comment about God's attitude towards pride and humility. But if you think about the ultimate form of pride, really, the ultimate form of pride is to think you don't need God, you know, to just be dependent on yourself alone and push God to the side. That's the ultimate form of pride in your heart. And hear this very clearly, friends. If the person who is proud in that way and continues to be proud in that way for all of their days and never acknowledges their need for God, God will oppose that person. Not just throughout their life, but ultimately the end of their life. They will be judged for their opposition toward God, resisting Him, being proud and pushing Him away. But to the humble, God shows favour. And the ultimate form of humility is to be someone who, from your centre, your core, your belief, says, you know what, I'm broken. I'm sinful. I need to be saved. I'm going to go to my God humbly and receive his salvation that he's come to bring to me, for me. You know, and God shows favour to the humble. So humility is at the very core of what we must understand. It's what calls us to call upon God for salvation, and it's the very dress code that we're to live in right throughout our lives, a whole lifestyle of humility. And it's not simply for your survival as an individual. This letter is written to the church, that the church, what it says there is it says we need to clothe ourselves with humility toward one another. One of the key dynamics we need to pursue together, one of the things that's going to enable us to survive and thrive together is humility. Humility is the key and pride is the killer. What takes churches down, what takes leaders down, what takes individuals down is pride. But humility is gorgeous. It's the fruit of life and health. Peter gives a number of ways for us to pursue humility right throughout the letter. And in this final chapter, I can see about eight things, but I'm going to kind of focus in on just four for the sake of time. Four of the key ways that Peter calls us as the church to pursue humility toward one another together. Four things the church needs to do to survive and thrive. The church needs good leaders. The church needs people who submit. The church needs to be humble and prayerful in its trust of God. And the church needs to resist the enemy, the devil. So we'll see if we can get through those four things tonight. And all those four things hang off the central concept of humility. That's the big thing. Yeah? So the first thing, what the church really needs is good leaders. Look at verses 1 through to 4, and we'll just read them again, let them soak in. To the elders among you I appeal as a fellow elder and a witness of Christ's sufferings, who will also share in the glory to be revealed. Be shepherds of God's flock that is under your care, watching over them. Not because you must, but because you're willing, as God wants you to be. Not pursuing dishonest gain, but eager to serve. Not lording it over those entrusted to you, but being examples to the flock. And when the chief shepherd appears, you will receive the crown of glory that will never fade away. So the first section is addressed to elders, it says, in the church. Now, what does it mean to be an elder in the church? I grew up with my dad saying to me, son, respect your elders. So I was, you know, thinking, okay, an elder is someone who's older than me, and you've got to respect people who are older than you. Good principle in life. But when Peter uses the word elder here, he's not simply saying, everyone who's old in church, listen up. No, really, when he says the word elder, he wants to speak to the leaders. It's anyone who has a particular position, you know, or office in church life of leadership. He wants to address them. And he addresses them by, you know, to the elders among you, I appeal as a fellow elder. So the minute he starts to give instruction to the leaders of the church, Peter models humility in the way he does it. Because he could have said, listen, leaders, as one of the apostles of the New Testament church, listen up. But he doesn't. He says, look, as a fellow elder, really, he kind of describes himself on their level. Gets down, humble among them, and says, look, I'm one of you guys, I'm with you, I'm an elder like you, living in this dynamic of being a witness of Christ's sufferings, who will also share in the glory to be revealed. I'm suffering too. I'm paying the price too. I'm participating in the sufferings of Christ too now, and I'm just looking forward to the glory that will be revealed on the final day. I'm in this with you guys. We're on the same level. He models humility right there from the get-go. And verse 2, he says to them very simply, leaders, be shepherds. Be shepherds of God's flock. Now that word shepherd, the equivalent word for us is the word pastor. They're, you know, similar words. Shepherd, pastor. The idea of being a shepherd is you're the one who looks out over the flock. You oversee, you watch over all of the sheep. You're concerned for all of them at the same time. And this concept of shepherd comes up all the way through the scriptures. Initially, we see the concept of shepherd kind of coming out of the Bible as God describes his role over his people. You know, we read from Isaiah chapter 40, where you know, God is described as the one who tends the sheep of his flock. You know, that our God is the shepherd. He's the one who's the shepherd over his people. And what might come to mind for you as well is Psalm 23, you know. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not be in want. Our God is our shepherd. But here he is addressing the leaders of the church as shepherds, because God actually sets up a system of under-shepherds, those who would shepherd his people on his behalf. And actually, in the Old Testament, the leaders of God's people, Israel, you can pick it up in Ezekiel chapter 34, the leaders are doing a terrible job as shepherds. And God just kind of bites right into them and tells them how poorly they're doing it. And he says how he's going to remove them. And he says, you know what, I'm going to come and shepherd my people myself. You guys are doing such a terrible job. You're abusing the flock. You're fleecing the sheep. You're leading them for your own gain. I'm going to take you out of the picture. I'm going to come and lead them myself. And friends, that concept is ultimately fulfilled when Jesus comes. And you might recall some of the words that come out of Jesus' own mouth, John chapter 10, where Jesus says, I'm the good shepherd. You know, the good shepherd is the one who lays down his life for his sheep. Friends, our God is our shepherd. He's the ultimate He's the ultimate good shepherd. He's the one who sacrifices himself to find his sheep, feed his sheep, and guard his sheep. And as Peter's giving these instructions to the leaders in the church, I wonder, I can't help but to think whether what's ringing in Peter's ears is Jesus' own words to him. You might remember John chapter 21 where Jesus says to Peter three times, he says, mate, feed my sheep, you know, care for my lambs, feed them, mate. And now here's Peter's passing on that. So while God is the ultimate shepherd, he sets up leaders over his people, under-shepherds or sub-shepherds who are to lead on his behalf. But Peter reminds the leaders of the church of the fact that these people do not belong to them in the way he instructs them. He says to the elders among you, I appeal as a fellow elder. Sorry, verse 2, be shepherds of God's flock. That's really important for a leader to understand. You're leading people who are not yours. They do not belong to you. They belong to God. They're his flock. They've been entrusted to your care. Do a good job looking after them. I always get panicky when people ask us to look after their pets when they go on holidays. You ever been asked to do that for people? People's pets always die in my care. Like, don't lend your pets to me. I don't want the responsibility. And they always tend to, I mean, it's one thing for goldfish to die. I mean, they always die, don't they, when you give them to someone. But when someone lends you their rabbit or entrusts you with their dog, I mean, if they entrust you with their cat and it dies, not a problem at all, but the dog, right? It's a huge responsibility, isn't it? So if you do ever actually entrust your pets to someone else, as you give the pet to them, just make sure you say to them, look, if this animal dies, it's okay, all right? Just let them off the hook a little bit, because it's a huge thing to be entrusted with the care of someone else's precious possession. The leaders in God's church have been entrusted with something far more precious than a pet. God's own people, what a huge responsibility. And leaders in the church are to understand that responsibility, understand that they're entrusted with caring for God's flock. Verse 4 reminds us that Jesus is the chief shepherd. He's the one who is the senior pastor of the church, if you want to say. And there are many under-shepherds. If a leader in the church understands this, they'll understand that they are just one of the sheep as well, actually. Nothing special. Just one of the sheep entrusted with a particular responsibility from God to care for his. There's the first one. Be good leaders. Sorry, that's not the end of good leaders. There's more. Peter's got lots more to describe what it means to shepherd. In fact, what he does is he gives somewhat of a warning to leaders as you shepherd God's people, and he warns leaders about, I think, three areas of pretty common temptation that leaders in the church can fall into. Leaders can end up feeling resentment that they're in the role. They can be after personal gain. They can be after power for themselves. And so what Peter does, he works through now, and he says, look, to the leaders, Don't be like this, be like that. And he does it three times. Not that, but this. Halfway through verse 2, you get the first not. Not because you must. You shepherd the flock. Not because you must, but because you're willing, as God wants you to be. So not because you must. Not because you feel dragged into the role under pressure. Not finding yourself grumbling that you have the responsibility and groaning that you bear the weight and feeling resentful like you really don't want to do it. Not feeling like leadership is an unwanted burden for you. Now, why would it that leaders from time to time feel like it's something that they don't want to do? Well, in this context particularly, when the church is being persecuted, who normally gets dragged off first? It's the leaders, usually, that have got a target on their backs. And when persecution breaks out, it's usually the leaders and pastors of churches that are most visible and easy to grab and take off and persecute first. And so there is a cost. And you can imagine the cost of being a leader in this kind of time period. And quite possibly for us, as we live in an environment that gets increasingly hostile for the Christian. It may very well be that we see in our time leaders suffer first and more than the rest. But Peter says here, you've got to understand, you've got to make sure you understand that. And you've got to make sure if you're in a position of leadership, you're not there feeling like you're not wanting to be there, pressured to be there, groaning about it. But lead because you're willing. Lead voluntarily if you've been asked to step up. But step up, take it on. Know what's coming for you. And ultimately, understand this. Understand the incredible privilege that it is to have God's flock entrusted to you. Understand the incredible blessing that it is to actually suffer and bear the name of Christ ahead of others. Know what you're in for and be willingly say, yeah, give me a bigger privilege to live for than that one. Being a shepherd in God's people. Know what it is, don't whinge about it, take it on, be willing to pay the cost for it. Second thing Peter talks about, it's still verse 2. He says, not pursuing dishonest gain, but eager to serve. Not pursuing dishonest gain, but eager to serve. So not being greedy for money, effectively, and pursuing dodgy practices in the church to actually get personal wealth for yourself. If you're a leader in the church, make sure you never do your ministry as a means of making money. That does not mean leaders in the church can't be paid, that it's bad to pay leaders. Jesus makes that clear, Matthew chapter 10. It's okay to earn a living from being a leader in the church, but it's bad to minister greedy for money. Sadly, we've seen leaders in the church throughout history that have ministered for that very reason. And they do that because leaders, ministers, shepherds are sheep with broken hearts themselves and so are susceptible to all the same sin. And the sin of greed is there knocking at the door. And not just greed for money, but it can be the greed for any kind of personal gain in general, leading in the church. You know, greed for more prestige or more approval or a higher position so that you feel respected by people around you. Peter says, no, if you're going to lead, do not make this about you. This is not for you. Don't think personal gain. Now, just so you know, with paid staff here in this church, being aware of the susceptibility towards greed, the way we try to protect paid staff in this church, there's a few things we do. Number one, we have a set salary that we set according to an external system to ours, which is the Sydney Anglican system. So the paid staff in our church get paid a little below the equivalent of Sydney Anglican levels, so that it's not about working hard to get paid more money. No, your salary's pretty much set. The other thing that we have is we have guidelines on not accepting gifts from people. So if you particularly value a ministry from a paid staff in church and you come up to them, you're wanting to show your appreciation and try and give them cash, they won't accept it. Or if they do, they'll hold it like this and they'll walk over to the church office and put it in the place where the money goes, into the general giving, into the operations budget. And if you do, you know, and as you feel encouraged and ministered to, and you God's stirring your heart to be generous, give generously through the bags or online. Don't go giving it to anyone, because we actually don't want anyone to be ever ministering for personal gain themselves. So you don't need to do that. There's just a few of the things that we do put in place. But leaders are to minister, make sure they're not pursuing dishonest gain, but they're to be eager to serve. Eager to serve. That's the very heart of leadership. Service, which is where we get our word minister from. A minister, literally, is a servant. That's what it is to lead in the church. It's to serve. And Peter says here, you need to be eager to serve. You need to be keen and zealous and enthusiastic to lay your life down for the sake of others. That's what leadership in the church looks like. It's very different from leadership in the world, Jesus points out. Leadership in the church is to serve others. And friends, there's nothing uglier than when you get a sniff or a glimpse of a leader, particularly in the church, who's actually got proud self-interest at heart as he or she leads. It's terrible. It's terrible for the church. Leaders that pursue humility and service. Third one, verse 3. Leaders, serve, not lording it over those entrusted to you, but being examples to the flock. So not lording it over people. Don't be on a power trip. Don't be dominating and harsh. Don't do it because you love being the boss man with the position of authority and getting respect from people and bossing them around. You might call that over-shepherding or harsh shepherding. And if you've been in other churches in the past and you've experienced a hard time with leadership, it's usually probably because there's failure in one of these three areas. And people do sometimes talk about some level of spiritual abuse or emotional abuse that they might suffer under leaders, leaders that are likely lording it over others and commanding them how to live rather than serving them and coming alongside them, thinking that the people are theirs to command around. Jesus, Matthew chapter 10, says that's worldly leadership. Leadership in the church should not be lording it over, but being an example. So leadership in the church is to be an example. Now, that's what the ancient shepherd used to do with the flock. The way you would lead the flock if you're a shepherd in the ancient world is not from behind, cracking the whip and using, you know, cattle dogs or whatever. I don't know, that's about my limited understanding of moving animals forward. Behind. In the ancient world, the shepherd would go out in front of the flock and walk ahead of the flock and call out to the flock to follow him, and the flock would know his voice and follow. So the concept of being a shepherd is to be the example, the one who goes first, the one who leads the way, so that the flock knows where we're heading and what it means. And so leaders in the church are to be shepherds. They're to be the ones who lead the way in service as ministers of the gospel. Now, verse 4 does tell us there is a level of reward for those who lead in the church. Have a look at it. When the chief shepherd appears, you will receive the crown of glory that will never fade away. When the chief shepherd appears, that's when your reward's going to come. And your reward is going to be that crown of glory that never fades away, which is the eternal inheritance. A leader serves and sacrifices and lives as an example, suffering in the present, paying the high price and cost in the present, knowing that the reward's going to come down the track. You don't need it now, don't pursue it now. And in that way, you're being a great example to everyone else in the church, because that is the very nature of Christian living, is to actually serve and suffer and follow Christ now, enjoy glory later. That's the nature of Christian living. Now, who does the shepherding in church? At EV here, you might, if you want to talk about the shepherd of EV, it's Andrew Hurd. If you want to talk, you know, there is a shepherd who watches over the whole. But we have also many paid shepherds in this church. But the shepherding and pastoring is not even done simply by those. The shepherding and pastoring in this church is shared very broadly as we can, so that we can do as much shepherding and pastoring as possible. And many of you are involved in it. Growth group leaders, community leaders, area leaders, youth leaders, kids leaders. There are so many of you lead and you shepherd and you pastor in some way or another. And so please take note of the principles that are being put forward here and instructed here to leaders. Take them on board. Live this way. There's the first thing. Instructions to leaders. The church needs good leaders. That's what it needs. Secondly, the church needs people, the flock, to submit to good leaders. Verse 5. In the same way, you who are younger, submit yourselves to your elders. In the same way, you who are younger, submit yourselves to your elders. Now, when it says younger, it likely is being addressed to younger people in the church. Apparently, younger people in the church have a tendency to be a little more rebellious and adventurous, and younger people need to be encouraged and reminded to submit to leadership and authority in all moments in history and in all different cultures. So it is likely that younger people particularly are being addressed here and saying, you make sure you remember to submit. But I think it's not simply young people. Considering that elders doesn't just mean oldies, but means leaders, I actually think younger people doesn't simply mean young in age, but basically all those under leadership. So everyone else in church, everyone who's under leadership, submit. Now, there's a sense in which we're all under leadership. Everyone finds themselves under leadership in the church in some way. And so the question for us all to consider is this: how well do you respond to leadership? How well do you respond to direction and shepherding over you? Because I think there's probably somewhat of a spectrum that we all find ourselves on. Some of us, not many of us because we're Aussies, but some people might find themselves right up this end of the spectrum, which I would suggest is those who are overly reverent toward leaders in the church. It's not very Aussie to be like that. We usually like to tear down our leaders. But perhaps some of you lean towards that end of the spectrum where you've been to a church where you've been told that's what you do with the leaders. You bow before your leaders. You do exactly what they say. You don't challenge them ever. And so you've got a bit of over-reverence towards leaders in the church. You might actually need to be encouraged to understand that the leaders in God's church are just sheep, entrusted with great responsibility, but just sheep. So don't treat them like they're gods. They're just men and women. Yeah? I'd say most of us, though, are probably down towards the bottom end of the spectrum, where we have a tendency to be a little bit dishonouring towards our leaders in our country, in our schooling, in our work environment, and in the church. A little bit disrespectful towards our leaders. So wherever you sit on the spectrum, you need to ask yourself, what does it mean for you to submit gladly and humbly before the leadership that God has put over you? Usually we use a whole bunch of excuses when we don't want to submit, we don't want to follow instruction. It's usually got to do with pointing out faults in the leadership over us. And if you want to go looking for faults in the leaders that are over you, you'll find them. I'll give you a list of mine if you want, you know. And if you use that as an excuse why you should never submit, you'll always have trouble submitting. We're told exactly why here we are to submit to leaders. Verse 5, in the same way. That little phrase there, Peter uses it a number of times in his letters. And when he says in the same way, he's effectively saying this: for the Lord's sake, submit to your leaders. Yeah? Conscious of God, submit to your leaders. Submit to them because God put them there. So as you submit to them, you're submitting to God. As you honour them and obey them, you're honouring and obeying God. You do it for the Lord's sake. We submit. Now, as we're throwing these things around and considering what it means for us to live humbly towards each other and leaders to be a certain way and all of us to submit to the leaders over us, I'll be the first to admit that this is not easy. This is not an easy way to live. It doesn't come naturally to us. In fact, there's a lot pushing against you to hold you back from living this way. Three big ones of this. There's your own sinful heart, because you're broken. And just by nature, you will at times, possibly lots of times, just not want to do what you're told to do in all kinds of settings and even in the church. Yeah? So your own sinful heart is pushing against you living humbly and submitting to leadership in the church. Secondly, we live in a culture where we're very easily influenced to just pursue yourself with disregard to anyone else, you know. So we live in a culture that actually does not encourage humble submission at all. And thirdly, we have an enemy. We have an enemy that's actually tempting us and trying to get us to stop living this way. There's those three things. So the final two things that I want to talk about tonight are number one. The third one is, you know, humble yourself before God. This is going to be very key to us. Humbly pray before God, and then resist the devil. So they're the final two things in line with what's pushing against us. Have a look at verse 6. Humble yourselves, therefore, under God's mighty hand, that he may lift you up in due time. Cast all your anxiety on him because he cares for you. Humble yourself before the Lord's mighty hand, which is to actually humbly and gladly come under God and acknowledge his sovereign control over all of life. This is particularly hard to do when hardship is happening for you. And even persecution for being a Christian is happening for you. We're being told here to humble yourself under the mighty hand of God. Acknowledge he is God, we are not. He knows what he's doing. He's looking out for us, and he will raise us up in due time. Trust him. Humble yourself before him. And friends, as you humble yourself before God, this does actually enable you to humbly submit to other authorities, human authority here on earth. In fact, I'd say that's one of the primary evidences that you are humbly submitting to God. I think actually you can tell. You can tell when someone's humbly submitting to God because you can see them being humble in their submission to earthly authorities. I think it's one of the key evidences. So if you're someone who continually displays rebelliousness towards any authority that's over you, chances are in your heart you're just rebellious towards God as well. And we're told here ultimately, humble yourself before God. Submit to him. Part of that is to, verse 7, cast your anxiety upon him because he cares for you. It's easy to feel anxious about submitting and being humble. Yeah? In fact, Peter acknowledges earlier when he speaks to wives, he says, don't give way to fear. It's easy to feel fearful and anxious about this concept of submitting, entrusting yourself to someone else. Who's going to look out for me? There are a whole bunch of things we can be anxious about in all this, and God acknowledges that, and he says, I'll tell you what to do with your anxiety. I'll tell you what to do with your worries, particularly about submitting and being humble. Cast them upon me. Chuck them at me. Come to me. Give them to me. Pray to me. I know what you're going through. Throw them upon me. Trust me, I care for you. I can take your anxieties. I can help you. I'm your shepherd. I'm the one who cares for your soul. Cast your anxieties upon me. Now, that's a general instruction. With all of your anxieties, cast them upon God. But particularly the anxieties that can well up in us when we're considering the risk of humbly submitting. Cast your anxieties upon God. The fourth one that we're told as a church, this is what we need to do as a church to survive and to thrive. We are to resist the devil. Resist the devil. Have a look at verse 8. Be alert and of sober mind. Your enemy, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion looking for someone to devour. Resist him, standing firm in the faith, because you know that the family of believers throughout the world is undergoing the same kind of suffering. Be alert and sober-minded. Your enemy, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion. One of the things we need to be aware of as Christians is that we have an enemy. And Peter wants the Christians to be aware of that. He wants them to be alert and sober. We have an enemy because we're with God, and God has an enemy. And God's enemy desires to take down those who belong to God. And we're to make sure we're not ignorant and apathetic towards our enemy. You need to know your enemy. And we're told here that our enemy is like a roaring lion who's prowling around looking for someone to devour. Now, we don't live in a part of the world where we know what that's like, really. You know, if you come from South Africa or other areas of the world where you've heard a wild roaring lion nearby, you know what it's like. But we don't. I mean, what's prowling around in our neighbourhoods? Like possums and bush turkeys? It's like, woo! You know? We don't live in lion territory, so we're kind of unfamiliar with this. So it might be that we don't catch it really quickly. I tell you what I have been noticing lately, though, is a whole lot of shark attacks, yeah? So perhaps what might be a little bit more helpful for us is when you're in the ocean, when you're in the water, and there's been a lot of shark attacks, you need to be aware that there are sharks in the water, because apparently there are. A few people have been getting nibbled lately, okay? About a year ago, I was out with the kids down at Umina, my two eldest kids, surfing, and some clubbies, you know, surf clubbies came past in their inflatable boat with the little wah, 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 came flying past, waving their arms, there's a shark, get out of the water. And my kids, like, eyes are popping out of their heads. They look at me and they say, "What did he say?" And I said, "There's a shark." They think we should get out of the water. And I hadn't even really finished saying it, and the two of them are off. You know, they've paddled faster than I've ever seen them paddle before. Like, I'm always trying to get them to paddle harder, you know. The classic dad in the water, paddle for the wave, right, when it's coming, right? And I tell you what, I should just yell, "Shark," you know, because those kids took off and their arms look like those cartoon characters that just go like this, right? They were flying. They hit the beach so quickly. As they were paddling towards the shore, I was giggling, watching them, and I came so close to saying, "It's right behind you," you know, like, oh, I didn't. And that's a kind of right response, isn't it, to just scream and run and paddle, you know, to the shore. Now, I didn't head straight in. I stayed out because, you know, everyone goes in, then you get the wave to yourself. So stayed out for a little while. I probably shouldn't have. That caused them even more distress. But, you know, that's the appropriate response, isn't it? There's a shark and all of a sudden you're more alert than you've ever been. Yeah. You're more sober than you've ever been. You're reacting and you're responding. There's an enemy. You're in enemy territory. You need to act appropriately. And Peter's using that imagery of the lion to kind of say, friends, you've got an enemy and you're living in lion territory. You need to be alert and aware and be watching. Yeah? We've got an enemy. Now, we need to understand our enemy. We don't need to talk about him all the time, and I'll tell you why that in a minute. But if he's like a roaring lion, what we do need to understand is this. He's not just this. The enemy, the devil, is not just an evil force that's out there. He's a person. Yeah? He's a person. And when you put together some of the passages in the scriptures, and we don't get all the information we'd like to have, but when you get all the information together from passages like Isaiah 14, Ezekiel 28, Revelation 12, it would appear as though the devil is a fallen angel who was booted out of heaven along with the 30 other angels because he was proud, because he couldn't sit humbly submitting to his God. He needs to leave. That is who the devil is. And what's he up to now? Well, here's one thing we need to understand. The devil has been defeated already. Yeah, Colossians chapter 2, as Jesus died with our sin and then rose again from the dead, he defeats sin and the devil, sin and death and the devil. So the devil really has already been defeated, but he's prowling around and he has a certain amount of length on the rope and he's attempting to do everything he can to wreak havoc among God's people. And he's very intentional and he's very purposeful. And he works hard day and night, and he never knocks off. And he's looking for someone to destroy. His mission is to destroy you, which particularly is to destroy your faith. What the devil wants more than anything else is that you would eventually dishonor God and stop living for him. What he desires most is that we, as a church, would not be effective on mission at all in sharing the gospel, that we would just wind down, grow cold, drift, and fall away entirely from Jesus. That's exactly what he wants. And he works hard night and day to try and get that to happen. How does he do that? How does our enemy, the devil, work hard to try to destroy our faith like that? Well, I'll tell you what he doesn't do. He doesn't hide behind trees and jump out and go boo and try and scare people, right? He doesn't run around in a red suit with a pitchfork and tail out of his back. He doesn't act obviously trying to freak us out, at least in this culture, in the West. That's not what he does. What he does do is he just disguises himself. He masquerades as the angel of light. He's subtle and he's clever. Chances are, when you come across the influence of the enemy, it may have the appearance of wisdom and goodness. But at its heart, it's trying to get you to believe God. Our enemy is continually trying to tempt us and distract us and consume us so that we're left with desire for lifestyle and leisure and success and self-fulfillment and selfish ambition and proudly pursuing our own glory. That's what the devil wants. He wants you pursuing things for yourself. He wants to lure you away from humbly submitting to God and pursuing him and just get you on your track. And the way he does that is basically just by lying to us continually. Jesus actually says that the devil is the father of all lies. When he lies, he speaks his native tongue. His name literally means deceiver. And he wants you, he's been lying from the very beginning. He lied to our first parents. One of the first things that the devil actually said to Adam and Eve was, did God really say, you will not surely die? Just lies. Right from the beginning. And he's been doing it right through history and he's doing it today. He's lying and he's trying to get you to believe his lies. He's trying to get you to believe his lies, and it would be his lies right now to us today would be the very opposite of what we've just looked at in verse 6. He wants you to believe the opposite of this. So instead of, look at verse 6 with me, instead of humbling yourself before God, he wants you to be proud. Yep, and he wants you to feel like it's okay to be proud. Therefore, under the God's mighty hand, he wants you to think, when you're going through a particularly hard time, think, God's mighty hand, it doesn't seem very mighty right now, doesn't seem to be able to protect me from this, doesn't seem to be able to help me out here, doesn't seem like he's in control. And if he's in control, how good can he be? You know, maybe he doesn't even care about me. He wants you to believe the opposite of that he will lift you up in due time. The devil wants you to actually think, you know what, this is not working, living for God. And I don't know that I can put my hope in the end reward that I'm going to be lifted up. This is not working, so I'm going to actually try and make my life work myself. I'm going to pursue my own goodness, my own way now, and I'm not going to submit anymore. And my anxiety and my fear is going to drive me towards a life of pride that just pursues my own glory now rather than humbly submitting. That is what our enemy wants us to do. So when you feel those desires well up in you, when you hear those types of messages coming at you from friends and from family and from media and from culture, and you're tempted to believe the lie that God's not really good or not really in control and the glory is not really to come and really he should be doing more for me right now, and this is not really, when you're tempted to think that way and believe that way, here is how you resist the devil. In your mind, in your heart, you notice when that's happening. You notice you're being tempted and you actually resist it. You actively preach the gospel to yourself. You open up to passages like this and remind yourself of the truth and you cling to it. You stand fast in the truth of who your God is and what he's doing and where he's taking all things. You continue to put your trust in him. You stand firm in your faith. You trust that he's the chief shepherd, the overseer of your soul. Chapter 2, verse 25. That's what he is. He's the overseer of your soul. He's got you. He's got you and he's good. You trust him. Keep humbly submitting to him. Understand your inheritance is being kept for you. It will never perish and spoil or fade. It's okay. It's okay. He's got you. Verse 9 and 10, we'll finish on this. 9, Peter kind of reminds, look, you're not the only ones who are going through this. You've got brothers and sisters around the world who are suffering as well. And friends, if you feel like you're suffering for Christ now, just get on the internet, you know, and have a look at what your brothers and sisters are suffering elsewhere. Yeah, our brothers and sisters are suffering far more than we are right now. You're not alone. Hang in there. Christians have suffered through every generation. We will in ours, possibly in an increasing way. Verse 10, we cling to this. Have a look at it with me. This is what we trust. This is what it means to humbly entrust ourselves to God as we cling to this. And the God of all grace, who called you to his eternal glory in Christ, after you have suffered a little while, will himself restore you and make you strong, firm, and steadfast. We're to trust that our God is a God of grace. He's so gracious towards us. He's called us to his eternal glory. He's called us to that. Long for that. Know that we will suffer for a little while. This life, in comparison to eternity, this is just a little while. Suffer for a little while, trusting this, that he will restore you. He will lift you up. He will make you strong, firm, steadfast. Friends, that is our future. To him be power forever and ever. Amen. Amen. Let me pray. Father God, we want to survive as your people. We want to thrive as your people. We thank you so much for this letter that Peter wrote, where we're encouraged to pursue a life of humble submission to all authorities, but ultimately to you. Lord, would you by your Spirit help us to pursue that life? We acknowledge our frailty, our anxiety, our fear. We cast that upon you. We want to entrust ourselves to you. You're completely trustworthy. Lord, help us to resist the devil by spotting his lies and turning away and clinging to the truth time and time again. Lord, would you do this work in us by your Spirit, as you have been doing it? Would you do it more and more so in the future? And we ask that for your name's sake. Amen.